This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The White House says that U.S. President Joe Biden expressed support for a ceasefire in a call to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu Monday after more than a week of Israeli-Palestinian airstrikes and rocket attacks.
President Biden is expressing support for a ceasefire in the week-long war between Israel and Hamas militants. The Biden administration had been signaling it would not pressure the two sides into a ceasefire, with spokeswoman Jen Psaki saying the focus is on working with partners in the region to reduce the violence.
Through quiet, intensive diplomacy.
But in a later call with Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu, the White House says the president expressed support for a ceasefire. Fellow Democrats had been pushing him to demand one. Top Senate Republican Mitch McConnell calls that nonsense, saying it suggests both sides carry equal blame.
I completely reject this obscene moral equivalence.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
And AP correspondent Joe Fetterman reports Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has received a political boost from the fighting with Hamas.
The current round of fighting appears to have given a boost to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Just a week ago, Netanyahu was fighting for his political life. His opponents were on the verge of forming a government that would have sent him packing. He had a chance to form his own government after Israeli elections in March, but he failed. The deadline passed. His opponents now have a one-month window to do so. They were very close to an agreement last week when the fighting erupted. Now that there's heavy fighting going on, it's much harder for them to form an alternate coalition.
And meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, speaking in Denmark on the first stop of an unrelated tour, said that the United States was ready to spring in to help if Israel and Hamas signal interest in ending hostilities. This is VOA News. India's COVID-19 crisis that has been most acute in the megacities is now penetrating the rural areas, home to nearly 70% of India's 1.3 billion people. Where limited public health care is posing challenges to the residents there. The first wave of the epidemic in India, which peaked in September of 2020, was concentrated in urban areas where testing was introduced faster. By the second wave that erupted in February this year is rampaging through rural towns and villages where testing is very patchy. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who is facing criticism for failing to prepare for the second wave, held a virtual interaction with top doctors of India on Monday to take stock of the pandemic situation across the country. Two of the United States' largest retailers are dropping face mask requirements in their stores. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
In response to last week's guidance from the CDC that fully vaccinated people didn't need to wear masks indoors anymore, Target and CVS say they're no longer requiring shoppers who are vaccinated to wear masks inside their stores. They didn't say how anyone would know if a shopper was inoculated or not. Target says vaccinated workers can also stop wearing masks, and it's offering time off to its employees to get a COVID shot. At CVS, though, workers will still have to wear a face mask regardless of their vaccination status. Friday, Walmart, Costco, and several other large retailers announced that they were dropping mask requirements for people who have been vaccinated. I'm Jackie Quinn.
The Japanese economy has contracted at an annual rate of 5.1% in January to March, slammed by a plunge in spending over the coronavirus pandemic. Seasonally adjusted gross domestic product data show household consumption dropped at an annualized rate of 5.6%, while government spending declined 6.9%. Much of Japan has been under a state of emergency centered around early closures of restaurants and bars to curb the spread of COVID-19. Dozens of people gathered in Tokyo Monday to speak up against the Olympic Games and yet another call for action to put an end to hosting the Games this summer. Protesters who feel strongly against the Olympics marched along the streets of Ginza, holding banners and shouting slogans to voice their clear opposition to the Games. More at VOAnews.com via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatey in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 18, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan makes progress on debt relief at the International Investment Conference.
France says it will cancel $5 billion in debt Sudan owes it, and Germany also offered assistance during back-to-back Paris financing summits targeting Khartoum's democratic transition and Africa's economic rebound from the coronavirus pandemic.
Civil society groups calls for reforms in Ghana's electoral processes. South Africa launches a new phase of COVID-19 vaccination. Environmental groups demand an environmental impact study from the Sierra Leone government. And Zambia's president picks a new female vice presidential candidate for the August election.
Professor Nkanduluo is an accomplished politician, public service worker, as well as an accomplished scientist that Zambia has produced. She has a very deep wealth of experience and understanding of how government operates.
And blind students in Somalia will take their first ever national exams in Braille. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. France says it will cancel $5 billion in debt that Sudan owes France, and Germany also offer assistance during back-to-back Paris financing summit targeting Khartoum's democratic transition and Africa's economic rebound from the coronavirus pandemic. For VOA, Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
The 2 days of high-level talks near the Eiffel Tower in Paris gather more than a dozen African leaders, along with top representatives of multilateral institutions, the European Union and China. Sudan was on Monday's agenda. 2 years after overthrowing longtime leader Omar al-Bashir, the country faces a raft of challenges, as Sudanese activists like Nasrin al-Saim noted in speeches, among them inflation topping 300% and shortages of basic goods. A big chunk of its $60 billion in foreign debt is owed to the so-called Paris Club of major creditors.
Une singularité de votre transition.
President Emmanuel Macron hailed Sudan's transition toward democracy as inspirational, saying the international community was on its side and that the country needed to be supported economically and politically. Sudanese Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok says the country, rich in natural resources, isn't looking for grants or donations, but rather wants the international community to explore investment opportunities. Africa-wide talks Tuesday focus on the economic fallout of COVID-19 that has decimated tourism and other sectors. Last year, the continent fell into its first recession in more than 3 decades. The World Bank estimates roughly 34 million new poor, people living on less than $2 a day in sub-Saharan Africa alone. Experts say COVID-19 has left the continent facing a $300 billion financing shortfall. Ahead of the talks, International Monetary Fund head Kristalina Georgieva told France 24 TV she hopes richer nations will use a planned $650 billion boost in IMF's reserves to help the region power ahead.
We do hear a great deal of concern among the advanced economies of this dangerous divergence. Advanced economies pulling out, low-income countries falling further behind. Why this is not only an ethical concern, it is also an economic concern, because this divergence would mean more insecurity, more instability, and lost opportunities for the world economy to grow.
Oxfam International is also worried Africa is falling behind for somewhat different reasons. Peter Kamalingin, Oxfam's Pan-Africa Program Director, says giving Africa access to COVID-19 vaccines and technology is key.
The second thing, of course, is we are seeing quite a lot of the conditions that the IMF and the World Bank are continuing to give, the conditions on the loans. I think it is yielding into a lot of austerity, and that means a lot, particularly for the vulnerable parts of the population.
The summit, attended by leaders from Rwanda, Mozambique, and Egypt, is also seen as another chance for Paris to broaden its influence beyond Francophone Africa. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Zambian President Edgar Lungu has named a new female vice presidential candidate ahead of the August 12 presidential election. She is 70-year-old Professor Nkandu Luo, who will replace current female vice president Inange Mutukwa Mwina. Some Zambians say the selection of two female vice presidential nominees in successive campaigns is a good example that President Lungu is a promoter of gender equality. Professor Nkandu Luo served in numerous ministerial positions, including most recently Minister of Livestock and Fisheries. Some university students blamed her for killing university student unions when she was Minister of Education. Her critics say she is confrontational and that she was selected to appease the Bemba ethnic group of northern Zambia. Antonio Mwanza is media director for the ruling Patriotic Front Party of Zambia. He says Professor Nkandu Luo is an accomplished politician and public servant who has a very deep wealth of experience and understanding of government operation.
First of all, Professor Nkandu Luo is an accomplished politician, public service worker, as well as an accomplished scientist that Zambia has produced. She has a very deep wealth of experience and understanding of how government operates, and she has been a senior member of the Patriotic Front for a very long time, where she's serving in the governing organ of the party called the Central Committee.
President Lungu, in announcing the appointment, said, quote, "I know not all of you will accept her, but diversity of opinion is what makes the world go around." Why did he say that?
Well, it's because the president is alive to the fact that whichever choice he would have picked, there will still be a section of the members who might not have liked that choice. Everybody, including the president himself, might not be liked by everybody. And the president was aware of the fact that it's not everybody who will like his pick. But he was also quick to note that one of the reasons why some people find it difficult to come to terms with the professor is the fact that she is extremely a very, very straightforward person, extremely honest, and she is sometimes tough. So naturally, some people find it difficult to work with people that are tough, that are straightforward, that are blunt, that are honest. And this is exactly what Professor Nkandu Luo is. She's very honest and she's not a pushover.
Talking about bluntness, we understand that while she was Minister of Education, she made some controversial decisions, and some people think that Zambian students may not like her.
Well, myself, I was the president of the university, and she's not a pushover. Particularly that, for instance, it was during her tenure as Minister of Education that meal allowances for the students were scrapped off. But that was necessitated by the fact that government wanted to increase the number of students who were receiving government scholarships. So to increase the number of students receiving government scholarships, there was need to increase the pace in terms of revenue. And the government thought that giving University of Zambia students and the Copperbelt University students meal allowance was a cost that could be taken to providing more students being given government scholarships. And that is one of the decisions that a number of students didn't take very well. But it was not entirely the doing of the professor. It was well crafted. And as we're speaking right now, we have more students on government loan than at any other time, because the money that was used to give meal allowances is now being used to give loans to other students. And then we have changed the scenario. More students now are benefiting.
So, Antonio, why do you think President Lungu dropped the current vice president, who we understand is also a woman? Why did he drop Madame Mwina?
Well, the current vice president, Her Honor Inange Mwina, did indicate officially that she was not running for public office again. She said that advanced age, she has contributed enough, and that it was time to pass on the baton to the younger generation. So she officially issued a statement that she would not be available as a running mate to the president.
How come, Antonio, people like us outside of Zambia, we don't seem to hear a lot about the female vice presidents? Why appoint them and people don't know about them?
No, I think that is a very wrong assumption. It is an assumption that people don't know about a Republican vice president. That's the second highest office in the land. And I don't think that it is correct to assume that people don't know their vice president. If there are people who are well known in any country, it's the president and the vice president.
Antonio, thank you so much. It's so nice talking with you on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you so much.
Antonio Mwanza is media director for the ruling Patriotic Front Party of Zambia. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. In Ghana, the civil society group Care for Free and Fair Elections is calling for legislative and administrative reforms in the country's electoral processes. The group says reforms would improve electoral security and restore public confidence in the independent electoral body to organize transparent and credible elections. Critics, however, say Ghana's elections have been adjudged as transparent and credible by both local and international poll observers. To learn more about call for legislative and administrative reforms, VOS Peter Clotty reached David Kumi Ado, Executive Secretary of Care for Free and Fair Elections.
Our call for electoral reforms is based on the fact that some of our electoral laws, we believe, are outdated. So it is not actually serving the purpose for which it served previously. Now we are realizing that there is a lot of agitation after our elections, and people are losing trust and confidence in the Electoral Commission because of the way some of the things are done, the conduct of the election itself, and the way the Electoral Commission manages our electoral system. We believe that it is time for us to have some reforms, administrative and legislative reforms, to deepen our electoral system for us to be able to have quality elections that will be accepted by all.
But David, some people are suggesting that the legislative and security reforms that you're seeking is neither here nor there, since both local and international poll observers often adjudge Ghana's electoral process as free, fair, transparent, and credible, in spite of certain minor infractions during the electoral process. How do you respond to that?
Well, in 8 years, we've had two presidential election petition. This does not tell that things are going right. If you look at the organogram of our democratic institutions, the Supreme Court falls at the base of that organogram, because the assumption is that the Supreme Court is the final arbiter in all electoral disputes. So the final verdict is given by the Supreme Court. We believe that if we don't do something about our electoral system, if we don't change some of the laws to suit current needs, people will lose confidence in the Electoral Commission. People will tend to lose confidence in the Supreme Court, who's have been engaging currently in our elections. This will hurt our democracy. This will not deepen our electoral democracy as we seek to have. So all indications point to the fact that things are not going well and things are not going right.
So what is the main administrative and legislative measure that your group wants to see implemented in Ghana that you think can safeguard and protect the electoral integrity in Ghana?
If you have an electoral commission who has an ambition to aid any political party in rigging an election, the electoral commission will formulate laws. It will be laid before parliament. It only needs to take 21 days for it to mature. But what we are calling for right now is for the CI to go through the same process that bills go through, that you have the relevant committees in parliament look through the laws. When there are some challenges, call the attention of the Electoral Commission to have to explain or change, so we can have laws that better fits the system we seek to have.
That was David Kumi Ado, Executive Secretary of Care for Free and Fair Elections of Ghana. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotty. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Batty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 18. South Africa launched a new phase of its vaccination scheme this week, rolling out vaccines to the over 60 crowd. Viewers Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The work begins in earnest now, with South Africa launching its second phase of vaccinations. Starting Monday, the vaccine will be rolled out to those over 60 years old. Health Minister William Kiese said the nation expects to receive more than 1.3 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine by the end of the month.
It is, of course, with great pleasure that we, as members of the National Health Council, wish to give some details to the public about the mass vaccination campaign that will kick off tomorrow. We know that everyone has been very anxious to know what will happen tomorrow and how we will start to vaccinate our most vulnerable citizens and then move on to vaccinating the general population.
Those over 40 years of age will be eligible for vaccines in July, and everyone over the age of 18 will be eligible in November. The government hopes to have 40 million people, the estimated number to achieve herd immunity, vaccinated by February 2022. South Africa's vaccination campaign has had some major setbacks as the nation reversed course on plans to use the AstraZeneca vaccine after studies indicated it might not be fully effective against the variant of the virus that is dominant in South Africa. Sharon Flint is the nursing manager for 15 Johannesburg area elder care homes with about 4,500 residents. While she agreed that the nation's vaccine rollout took longer than she had hoped, she said she's glad it's ramping up now.
We thought this was only going to happen much, much later in the year, so to have started it today is very exciting, and we're in regular contact with the Department of Health because they're going to be actually coming to the homes and the care centres for Methodist homes and all the other homes in South Africa. And we've trained our nurses in vaccinating, so we've got our sites ready. We've got all the equipment we need ready. Now we're just waiting for the government to give us dates. And they have started this week, so it's very, very exciting.
She said it has been a tough year for her residents. Some have succumbed to the virus. She declined to give numbers. And the rest have struggled because of restrictions that keep them from seeing their loved ones in person. Flint is in that situation herself. Her 92-year-old mother is in a care facility. We asked her what her plan is once her mother is fully vaccinated.
I'm going to take her out for breakfast. She can have chocolate for breakfast if she wants to. She can do whatever she likes. Just to put my arms around her and hug her. So I think it's going to be such a celebration.
That scene is likely to be repeated, with or without the chocolate, across the Rainbow Nation in coming months, as South Africa's elderly get this essential protection. Anita Pell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Activists and environmental groups are demanding to see environmental impact studies from the Sierra Leone government after a $55 million project was announced between the West African country and China to build an industrial fishing harbor on 100 hectares of beach and a protected rainforest. Sonkita Conte, head of Namata Sierra Leone, tells Ricky Strayer that they have not yet seen these studies and that there are multiple concerns about the potential harm to fishing resources, local livelihoods, and more.
Initially, we had seen reports about the land acquisition, and there were also talk of setting up a factory, a fishery factory there. And the reason why we knew about it was because one of my teammates, one of my Namati teammates, is affected. He's from that area. He's also a landowner, and so he raised that issue. He's working in one of our upcountry offices.
And as I understand it, you guys have asked to see environmental and social impact assessment studies. What has been the response when you asked for those studies?
So we have not received any response yet. Under the law, they have 12 days to provide a response, after which they accept that we can take based on the law to compel them to provide a response. So we wrote to the Ministry of Fisheries, certainly, to get information regarding the studies that were undertaken, possibly a draft copy, a copy of the grant agreement signed with the People's Republic of China. We'd like to see what they need. So we determined ourselves what the project would be for. And we also wrote to the Ministry, to the Environmental Protection Agency, which is the custodian of environmental reports and applications, to see if they had received any application whatsoever with respect to studies of environmental license for a project at Black Junction. And we also finally sent a letter to the Ministry of Land. Does this involve acquiring, in addition to the rainforest and the beach area, some 250 acres of land of the community? So we wanted to know from them whether they would be doing the acquisition completely or whether it was going to be an open sale.
What are some of your concerns when it comes to Black Johnson Beach and this proposed development?
I mean, there are several concerns we have. First off, we have massive environmental concerns. The coastal areas are very sensitive ecosystems. You do have areas where, you know, fish would spawn, so they would come in and lay their eggs and the young would hatch and then they would go in. And those areas also have mangroves as well. And so our concern primarily is with the environment, that a factory of whatever nature is in a harbor, as the Ministry of species is arguing would have adverse environmental impacts. And so we wanted to be sure that they were taking into account all the possible potential negative impacts of a project of that nature when they were agreeing on the fishing some of there. So we wanted to make sure that in the first place we have calculated the cost to the environment, and we have made a firm decision that it's worth taking on. And then second, we also concerned with the land rights of the community. If the government is going in to take land from them, is it necessarily a public property? Because this would be some sort of a business. They need to have complied with the rules on land acquisition for public purposes. And so we wanted to be sure that they are not violating the rights of community.
That was Sankita Conte, director of Namati Sierra Leone. You were speaking to Ricky Stryak from Freetown. Somalia's Ministry of Education has for the first time introduced Braille in schools for the country's blind and visually impaired people. Mohamed Kahir reports from Mogadishu.
The students of Al Basir School for Blind in the capital Mogadishu will sit for their final exams in Braille next week after the government launched a special education curriculum last week. Hassan Manur is among the visually impaired students at the school. Manur says he's looking forward to taking his final examination in the Braille system. He added that he's hoping to do well. The federal government has a new policy to develop learning programs for students with special needs. And so far, it has printed more than 8,600 books in 8 subjects as part of its new education plan. Nuria Aden Ise is a Somalia's Deputy Minister for Education.
We are launching 3 schools in Mogadishu, and our target is to spread the whole region in Somalia. So hopefully, children who are impaired with eyes will take benefit of that, and we are going to reach the other disability in the long run.
Students have reacted positively to the new learning system, but say other challenges remain, like the cost and lack of resources to help them reach their potential, according to the principal, Ismail Ahmed Ali.
Since they are coming from poor background families, their families cannot afford to pay their fee schools, so they are not able to support the school. That's why we are very, very, very patient to teach these children without being paid. Lack of awareness, some families, they are not aware what causes blindness. The children get very easily diseases which can make them to lose their special essential sight.
Somalia's education system, regarded as one of the best on the continent, is among institutions ravaged by decades of violence in the country. Mohamed Kahiye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
And that's it for this Tuesday, May 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butty in Washington, wishing you will have a very good day.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.